Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we welcome back Dr. Judy Wood. We talk with her about the critical thinking skills and problem solving she used to put together her book, Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. But first, let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's one. Texas students revolt against mandatory RFID tracking chips. We mentioned this a couple weeks ago, prompted by Dr. Catherine Elbrick's hard work and dedication, bringing awareness to the RFID tracking chips. The students at these two high schools, John Jay High School and Anson Jones Middle School, are mandated to wear the tags, which will track them on campus as well as when they enter and leave the school. There's a student, Andrea Hernandez, who is leading a group of students who refuse to wear the tags because, in her words, quote, "it makes me uncomfortable. It's an invasion of privacy." The effort to bring RFID tracking technology into the public domain like this will continue as long as people aren't aware of it. And again, this is the work of Dr. Catherine Elbrecht. She is also the co-author of Spy Chips. Here's another story. Sunshade to fight climate change, costed at $5 billion a year. Planes or airships could carry sun-dimming materials high into the atmosphere for an affordable price tag of below $5 billion a year as a way to slow climate change, a study indicated on Friday. Guns, rockets, or a pipeline into the stratosphere would be more expensive but generally far cheaper than policies to cut world greenhouse gas emissions, estimated to cost between $200 billion and $2 trillion by 2030. Transporting a million tons of particles to at least 11 miles above the Earth every year to form a sunshade is both feasible and affordable, U.S. scientists concluded in the journal Environmental Research Letters. The strategy, called solar radiation management, broadly imitates a volcanic eruption. The 1991 eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, for instance, blasted out a haze of sun-reflecting particles that slightly cooled the planet. The authors did not examine whether such, quote, geoengineering of the planet was a good idea. Other studies show it might have unwanted side effects, such as changing rainfall patterns. Well, here's one of those stories that give you part of the picture. If you've been paying attention to this show, you're familiar with the issue already, especially if you did get some of the DVDs that we've been offering on geoengineering, and you'd recognize some of the people who are involved in these stories, such as David Keith. He's at Harvard University now. He was at the University of Calgary. He says that there were serious risks in trying to dim the sun's rays, but it might also increase agricultural production by limiting impacts of climate change, such as heat stress. It's very confusing if you're not paying attention. David Keith, who probably getting funded by Bill Gates to be the front man for these geoengineering operations and to normalize it into the media, that's been going on now probably for the past 3 years. Other researchers on this topic, genuine researchers such as Dane Wigington, Michael Murphy, Rosalind Peterson, Cindy Bakulis out Long Island Skywatch, and many, many others have brought to the attention to listeners these aerosol operations, which mimic these geoengineering proposals, have been going on for at least a decade or more. Michael Murphy's new film, Why in the World Are They Spraying, is now out, and they had that big conference out in Los Angeles, Consciousness Beyond Chemtrails. Here in New York City, for an event titled Off the Radar Film Festival, which is primarily about issues around 9/11, I was asked to introduce Why in the World Are They Spraying at Theater 80 at St. Mark's in the East Village. That would be on Tuesday, September 11th at 4 p.m. We'll be introducing the film and we'll be taking questions with some of the people from Long Island Skywatch. If you're a listener to the show and you'd like to support the work of guests on this show, please come down to Theater 80 on St. Mark's. It's in the East Village. That's Tuesday, September 11th at 4 p.m. We welcome back Dr. Judy Wood. On the week of the 11th anniversary of the attacks on September 11th, 2001, we talked today about critical thinking as applied to the events that occurred on that day and how Dr. Wood has pointed out the evidence that many others didn't see. Why is that? Can we all learn to analyze visual information this way? As a former professor of mechanical engineering, Dr. Wood has extensive knowledge of the educational system and learning processes. She is self-taught and practices the method of defining the problem first before solving it. In the context of her amazing arc of research in the book, Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11, it is important to determine what happened before going to the next step of how it happened. These steps are done before moving to the next one of determining who did it. How have educational systems dumbed down our critical thinking? Dr. Wood has mentioned in past lectures and interviews that the public has been easily tricked, coerced, hoodwinked. We're gullible, mainly because of the lack in our problem-solving skills. The evidence presented in her book is not hidden. It exists right before us all. In past interviews, Dr. Wood has mentioned how our problem-solving skills and critical thinking have been stunted. And in this interview, she highlights the three main reasons. Dr. Judy Wood, welcome to Another News.
Well, hello. Thank you.
Well, it's really good to have you back on. But we're going to focus in on something that you have touched upon in past interviews, and that is critical thinking skills, but within the context of your work. Could you tell listeners why it's important to have this ability and to be critical in evaluating information surrounding the events on September 11th?
Well, it first comes to mind when I stop to think, why did so few people, on 9/11, why did so few people question it? And didn't they look and say, what's wrong with this picture? But instead, they were easily sucked in and went with the herd, the flow of, grab your pitchfork, going after the bad guy, and already had the case solved. I'm wondering, why is it even, my colleagues in front of the same television set in the faculty conference room were sucked into that? What is the difference? What is causing this? And I came up with three separate things that keep people from seeing what's going on, right, even if it's right before them.
Mm-hmm.
One is the problem-solving skills, the critical thinking. We'll come back to that. And the second one is groupthink. If everyone else thinks one way, and you don't, you start to wonder if you're wrong.
Oh, I see. That's a powerful influence.
Very. It's peer pressure. And even for me, I didn't see what everybody else saw. I saw a building coming apart, unraveling like a sweater. And these people didn't see it. Well, is something wrong with me, or is it with them? Or what's the difference? And I went up to my office and started making calculations. And I kept looking for what the difference was. And I couldn't find it. But unlike most people, I don't agree with the bandwagon because it's the majority. I have to know the reason. And so the third thing is the implications of what they're seeing. If they can't handle the implications, they're telling their mind they don't want to see it.
Okay, so you have problem solving, groupthink, and then
implications. Any one of those things will prevent the person from seeing what's before them. One or more. It could be a combination of things. But let's focus on the problem solving. So it's any of these three things that really cause people to not see what is being shown on TV and say, what? Okay, with the problem solving skills, let's start out. If I tell you the answer is 27, am I right or wrong?
No one would know.
Right, because you need to know what the problem is I'm solving. If I tell you the answer is 27, the answer to what? You have to understand what the problem is that I'm solving in order to understand if it's a right or wrong answer. So if you just give someone the answer, and people in our culture, maybe it's partly human nature, tend to start with the answer and work backwards, and they cherry pick the data that'll feed the right answer. If I tell you the answer is 27, then you go, okay, maybe it's, 3 times 9, or, you're speculating what the problem was. And if you speculate what the problem was, you're going to give data that will support your answer. and then it reinforces itself.
Now, okay, in the context of your work, can you describe this a little further?
Right. This is a simplification of it. That, you know, starting out with the answer instead of defining the problem. When it comes to 9/11, it becomes very important to first define the problem. Getting the steps in the right order, and it's all about the order. And I'll give another analogy. If someone tells you the numbers 4, 5, and 3, well, if you add 4 and 5 and multiply them by 3, or if you add 4 to the multiplication of 5 and 3, you get different answers. It's the order of those steps that becomes important. Okay, and with 9/11, the typical thing people start out with is a theory, and then they go looking for the data to support it. So if you say, let's see, it's with the various theories, it's fire or it's thermite or it's, you know, dynamite or nukes or mini nukes or, you know, one of those, then they go collect the data that supports whatever their theory is. So what they're doing is imagining the solution and then looking for the problem for which that is the solution.
And these solutions could be subtly inferred by the media, right, and other sources.
Right. Like before the second tower got its hole, I've got a picture of the TV screen where a little ticker across the bottom has something about bin Laden or Al-Qaeda on it. This is before the second tower got its hole, you know, 10 minutes after the first tower. And those kind of suggestions, even though it wasn't stated, those suggestions cause the viewer to make a conclusion. And once they made that conclusion, they go cherry-picking for data that supports it. Another example is a firefighter who was driving one of the fire trucks towards the scene and parks on West Street, and because he had a problem with the oil pan. Something damaged it. He ran over something that damaged it. Another one decided he must have run over, he saw something. It had to be the propeller from the airplane, because it was an airplane that hit the building, so it was a propeller that he ran over, not realizing these are not propeller planes. You know, he was seeing what he thought he was supposed to see. Again, it's interpreting the data to fit a conclusion. And so what you end up with is biased data collection, unintended. It's just partly human nature. And then pretty soon, it's a feedback loop, and you can never get to solving the problem that way, because you're not solving a real problem then. You're only solving an imagined one, because you've imagined what the answer is. It has nothing to do with reality. You must begin with determining what happened.
For listeners who may not be familiar with your work, could you summarize some elements of your book that you've arrived at through the right problem-solving procedures?
Well, you have to begin with the evidence, and you let the evidence lead to the conclusions, and not let the conclusions call the evidence. Let the evidence speak. So you just keep looking at the evidence, and through doing that, you quickly discover the towers did not burn up, nor did they slam to the ground, but they turned into dust in midair. The simplest arguments for that are that if they had slammed to the ground, you'd see a pile of rubble there. You know, two 110-story buildings, over a million tons of debris. Everything was like at ground level. You know, how do you explain that? And then if they'd slammed to the ground, you know, a million tons of debris slamming to the ground is certainly going to break the bathtub, the slurry wall, whatever you want to call it. The towers were built in the Hudson River on bedrock, 70 feet below the water table, with this sort of dike around it, sometimes referred to as a slurry wall or sometimes referred to as the bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
If you drop two 500,000-ton buildings onto that, you're going to damage it, and Lower Manhattan's going to be flooded. The PATH train, the subway trains, meet in there. And that did not happen.
Okay, let's go back for a minute back to the problem solving. You've given some answers to problem solving in the context of your work. Now, why do you suspect that the public has difficulty in problem solving based on general education in our society?
We aren't really taught problem-solving skills. Think about it. You know, how many times were you taught to memorize something with cue cards? You know, the times when I was teaching, One of the habits I saw that students had was to quick chance check the answer in the back of the book. And they stir the numbers around, punch them in the calculator, and check the back of the book. Nope, stir the numbers around again, punch them in the... They never look at what the problem is based on. Students tend to, you know, try to get the answer in the back of the book. They may even start out with that, and they get the numbers given in the problem to be solved. They don't read the problem. They just get the numbers, punch them in the calculator, check the back of the book. Nope. So they stir the numbers around again, punch them in the calculator, different permutation, check the back of the book. Nope. You know, they keep going around that circle, process of elimination, to get that answer. They never stop to look at what the problem is based on or what problem they're solving. It's very difficult, but they think they're taking a shortcut, but it's really much more difficult.
Is something in our brains atrophying because of this?
Right, people can be distracted and diverted easily. Let me go back to the various theories that people come up with, fire, thermite, dynamite, whatnot, and someone assumes that and then goes cherry-picking for the evidence. Now, consider it's something else other than what they've chosen from. You know, they're taking a multiple choice test, but the right choice may not be on that test. And if they function that way, they're never going to get to the answer. Not only that, different people have different guesses, which theory, and then they have an opinion about it. Pretty soon, it's just an argument of opinion, and you can never get there. They go round and round and round and round. If it's not based on evidence, you don't get to the answer. I don't know why people are so shy about addressing the evidence. Partly it may be that they go with the herd, and if the herd isn't addressing the evidence, then they tend not to. But it becomes very easy if you go step by step through the evidence. You have to first determine what problem it is you're solving. You know, if you're going to solve a math problem, you lay out the numbers. Are they getting added together or multiplied? And then you go to get the answer. You don't start with the answer, but you have to identify the problem that you're solving. But no one else has done that on 9/11 or for those events. What problem is it that they're solving?
Let's go to the second category of groupthink. Can you describe that a bit more in the context of your work and the events around September 11th?
Well, it is, people are afraid to get out of to step out of the norm. If you're in a room full of people and you say, I don't think it was this Al-Qaeda bin Laden person, and they turn around and stare at you, are you going to keep going? you're going to start thinking that you're wrong, because people tend to gravitate towards the herd. They don't like to be an outlier. Or we all have to have unity here. We need to be in agreement. Let's have unity. Let's all say it was thermite. And you, again, feel that you're a troublemaker if you don't go with the herd. It's a very powerful moving force. I've got a video on my website of the Ash conformity experiment. There was only one test subject, but he thought he was in a room full of test subjects. The rest of them were part of the experiment. And they went around the table with this, visual judgment. Is this line the same length or bigger or smaller than these other ones? And, which one is the same size? It's just observing. It's pretty obvious, for anyone. And the people before the test subject were giving the wrong answer. So the test subject decided he was going to give the wrong answer, too. That they must know something he doesn't know. Or he was afraid of not being part of the group, not being accepted.
Somebody pointed out to me that fear of public speaking can be traced all the way back to when we were running around in tribes, in groups. If you spoke out in the group, you were ostracized. And at night, you didn't have the protection of the tribe, and you would be eaten by animals or something at night.
Oh, I guess it was soon after 9/11, and I started noticing this, group think. I realized that is an animal instinct. You think of a field full of deer. One gets spooked and they all run. And only one of them knows why they're running. Or birds, one gets spooked and the whole batch of them takes off. Because it's safety. If a deer gets left behind, he's going to stay there chewing grass while the other ones run away. If it's because somebody's coming to eat them, he'll be the one that gets eaten.
That's another really good example of that pattern being applied to wildlife around us. And the influence of your peers can be so powerful. It can change your rationally thinking mind.
Right. That's what I mean about once you start with, you know, even this other thing where you start with the answer and then go cherry-picking the evidence, you don't even realize that's what you're doing. It preconditions you to be selective about what data you actually see.
So you mentioned the thermite as an example in the context of your work with groupthink. Dr. Wood, can you tell listeners why it isn't thermite?
Well, thermite is a welding material. And when you look at the evidence, the towers turned to dust in midair. They weren't welded to death. And when people say, it was thermite, well, what is it? You have to first define what it is before you can say it was thermite. You know, remember, step one of the problem is to determine what problem you're solving.
People think that thermite was used to make the towers come down or come apart.
Well, how was it used? What did it do? They claim they found aluminum powder and iron oxide in the dust. Well, if you turn the buildings to dust in midair, you're going to get those things in the dust. The buildings were steel structures with aluminum cladding. And if you dissociate the steel, you end up with a lot of iron particles. And they rust very quickly, so you have iron oxide.
And you've mentioned that thermite is, when it's used as an incendiary, it's very bright, flashes very bright.
People have seen, I'm sure, the 4th of July sparklers that, you know, they spit sparks,
mm-hmm.
and they're very bright. The towers would look like giant sparklers if a significant amount of thermite was used, that it could do anything about the destruction of the building.
See, this is the kind of thinking that I guess we don't have. And is it because of your extensive training in these areas that you're able to visualize these common sense ideas?
Well, it's also from you know, teaching the beginning engineering classes, engineering statics. It's kind of like boot camp, where, you know, I'm pretty strict at the beginning about you need to make on your homework, make a problem statement. What is the problem that you're solving? Draw a line across, you know, write what you are looking for, you know, what your objective is. Draw another line across, and then start solving the problem. You know, defining that problem very carefully and getting in the habit of defining it. And that is what's, you know, where people have failed to do that with 9/11. You know, what is the problem that they're solving? When they say it was thermite, what was thermite? That's the answer to what? What's the question? You know, what's the problem? And so you really need to look at, let's start with what happened. The buildings turned to dust in midair, most of the buildings. I'm not saying 100%, but a significant amount, well over 50%. You have all this dust generation. Well, whatever thermite did, if there was thermite there, it doesn't do that. And so it's a non-issue. And when people say, well, what about the planes? I say, well, airplanes can't do that either. Real planes can't do that, and neither can fake planes. So the plane issue is, you know, irrelevant.
Dr. Wood, let's go now to the third point that you mentioned, implication.
That is, the buildings turn to dust in midair. I think you have to acknowledge that. Why they did is a different issue, but the fact they turned into dust in midair shows that a technology that can do this exists. In other words, there exists a technology that can cause matter to turn into dust in midair. That's scary.
I agree, especially in the wrong hands.
That's correct. And I think many people don't want that to be real, so denying it is their solution.
I'm glad you put these together into three separate categories so we can now look at how people can maybe learn to view things they've never seen before within that framework. Is that possible?
Yes, and it might help them to just compartmentalize. You know, tune out what other people think. Tune out what you think the implications are. Pretend this is just, you know, in some abstract space, you know, in a movie or something that's separate from real life, so you don't have to worry about that issue. and just go exploring what the data says, what the evidence says. And if you have to start out and first determine what happened before you can solve how it happened. And that's before you can solve who did it and why they did it. And if you get those in the wrong order, you will never get to the solution. But if you get them in the right order, you'll always get there. A real-life example of this is the Casey Anthony trial. People were focused on the who did it. Well, what was it that got done? Apparently, the prosecution never proved what it was. It didn't mean that she was innocent, but they could not prove guilt because they didn't have a crime to charge her with. Well, thinking somebody killed the little girl isn't enough to convict them on, what's the crime? Is it, premeditated murder, or is it something else? Mm-hmm. And if you have not defined what the crime is, you can't prosecute someone for it.
I just want to jump in for a minute. Listeners, if you're hearing this beep, I don't know what that is. Dr. Wood can't hear it on her line. We're hearing it on our line here, so we don't know what that is. Bear with us.
But thankfully, the jury, voted, to not guilty. But that doesn't mean innocent. But the jury members said they didn't know how the child died. If you don't know how the child died, how can you charge someone with a crime if you don't know what the crime is? And if the prosecution had proved how the child died, that would be a different case. But if the crime has not been defined, how can you charge somebody with it? And the same thing for 9/11. We need to go after who did it. The heck with how it was done or why, we need to go get somebody for it. Well, that's a witch hunt. Until you know what the crime was, how can you prosecute somebody for it? It really makes me think we're going back to caveman days when somebody suggests that, it's a total eclipse of the sun. Somebody suggests that the lights went out because it's so-and-so's fault, so let's go get them.
Wouldn't people say to you, well, it's obvious what was done?
How is it obvious?
Well, the planes were flown into these buildings, and they came crashing down, and there's evidence that they were done by a group called Al-Qaeda. Here's the visual data that we have showing that.
Let's go to some TV drama on whodunit. Often, they make a big point of making sure that this person's fingerprints match that gun, or they have some evidence that they fired that gun. I didn't really appreciate that so much before now. But to be able to have a direct connection between the one being charged with the crime and the weapon and all sorts of other things, they even bring somebody in to identify, yeah, that's the man who shot the gun, or who said, whatever. They have to have that connection, so it isn't just being convinced on a hunch, because that's a witch hunt. And even more than that is, think of a magic show, but you weren't told you were at a magic show. You could swear you saw that person up at the front cut somebody in half with a saw. Does that mean that you should go call the police and report a crime?
Great example.
You'd think that this is what you see because you're distracted. The whole art of magic is to get people looking over here while you're doing the switcheroo over there, so that they don't see what's going on. And they can be so distracted that they don't know how it happened. How did this person pull a rabbit out of their shirt cufflink, or a rabbit out of a hat?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Wood, your book has been out for almost 2 years. The book is titled, Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. What has been the response lately?
Well, a lot of people don't hear about it. The 9/11 truther movement tries not to talk about it, either that or they claim the author is this or that, too tall, too short, they can't deal with the book. No one has refuted anything in the book at all. They can't. It's evidence, and you can't refute evidence.
No one has refuted the evidence in the book.
Correct. Nothing that's in the book have they refuted.
And this is a 500-page book filled with evidence of how the towers came apart in midair, and it's just exhaustive research. How long did it take you to put this book together?
Quite a while, doing the research for it and gathering things up, and then also getting the book free of a publisher who didn't want to publish it. And it came out 9 years after the event.
Well, Dr. Wood, I feel that we came somewhat close to understanding the way you approach these types of events and how you begin to think about them and begin your research. I think this is extremely valuable information to know, and I really appreciate you sharing that with us. We're at the bottom of the hour, and we're going to open up the phone lines. Are you ready to take calls?
Sure.
If you have a comment or question for Dr. Judy Wood about this show or her work, her book, give us a call at 212-209-2900, and we'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Our guest, Dr. Judy Wood, is explaining to us how she put together her book, Where Did the Towers Go?, the reasoning and the structure behind it. Dr. Wood, before we go to calls, I wanted to ask you about defining the subtitle of your book, Directed Free Energy Technology.
It's evidence of directed free energy technology.
Okay, yes, it is.
As we were talking before about the building turning to dust, it turned to dust. But primarily, it is not 100%, but well over 50%. It turned to dust in midair. So the fact that that data exists shows that there is some technology in existence that can do this. That technology can also provide us with free energy. So the evidence of 9/11, of what happened on 9/11, is evidence that technology that is capable of providing free energy exists. It's not saying that this is what was used. It's saying it's evidence of it, the existence of this technology.
And would you call it a signature that you were able to find evidence of?
Right, it's not kinetic energy, like as in a bomb or a missile heat like a nuke. Mm-hmm. It's directed energy. It's energy can be directed or manipulated in matter to cause it to do something else.
Gotcha.
And it's done without heat and done without like a hammer hitting something.
Yes, of course, of course. Well, Dr. Wood, we got a few calls on the line.
Great.
And we're going to go to the first call.
Good evening, Dr. Wood. It's always a pleasure to hear you. I especially enjoyed the event from London where you had lots of skeptics. I wonder if we could possibly get you out into the American population before the next election. I feel that you may be in some physical danger, but you seem to be such a Gaia energy that America needs to hear more of you, because you make sense, you doubt, you question, you represent everything about the old school of education, which is being sort of chartered out, and America is very, very grateful. I'm sure the world is grateful for your type of intellect and your ability to parse out and question, especially authority.
Wow. Well, thank you.
Caller, did you have a specific question, maybe?
No, I don't. I've been following Dr. Wood for many weeks now, and I think that this lady is just extraordinary. I was a former professional chef, and it was always like, well, I can't take you out to dinner because you know too much, you know. It's you are, and your program, mind you, are such a beacon of light in a smug-filled geo-engineered world, a GMO world, a world where authority takes precedence over thinking, it takes precedence over common sense. I'm just fascinated that we live in such a dullard nation.
The fast food kind of.
Yeah, oh, for sure. And watch out for all the effects now of the GMO. Even the little hamster babies have hair in their mouths.
That's
cute.
My book was written to empower the reader to be able to understand things for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the greatest compliment I got on the book was that it is a short course in critical thinking.
We don't bother with that here in America. We're syncopants. So we've been syncopating since, I would say, the McCarthy years.
I bet you're right about that. Caller, mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I really
thank
appreciate
you for everything you
Thanks.
Do. You're just wonderful. Thank you so much.
See, Dr. Wood, there are people out there that get your material. And I wonder if she has your book. I forgot to ask her. We have another call. Hi, you're on the air.
I'm glad to speak to Dr. Judy Wood. I just have a specific comment. I would just like to preference my comment.
I'm totally hearing that.
I can't hear you, caller. Is that?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Hello?
We're getting some static.
Hello?
I wonder if it's your line. Can you cut that line just to see if it's his line? No, it's Dr. Wood, it's your line. Do you have, can you mess with the cable or the cord to the phone?
Well,
yeah.
Okay, it's better for now.
Yeah, it's better for now. Jeez.
Hello? All right. I would just like to preference my comment by saying there's a lot of video and Photoshop out there right now. It's amazing what artists can do with CGI and special effects, et cetera.
What problem is it you're trying to solve?
Well, I'm just saying I saw a YouTube video. I know you can't believe everything on YouTube. That's why, you know, I said, let me preference by saying the video was, the editor had grayed out, had blacked out the screen and whited a specific area where the towers, you know, before the towers had fell.
Okay,
and
what does that have to do with what happened on 9/11?
I'm getting to it.
Okay.
What happened? Oh, okay, he was accidentally cut off. Sorry about that, caller. Please call back. Really apologize for that. We're going to go to the next call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Go ahead, caller.
Okay, I'm curious. Dr. Wood is saying that none of the technology known today could have done what was photographed and put on the news to the towers.
I'm not talking about what was photographed and put on the news. I'm talking about what happened on 9/11. You know, the evidence of what happened. Technology that can do that is not in the public domain, but it is known. There, you know, Nikola Tesla had done this and several others along the way, but it's not really advertised in public that much.
Okay, you mentioned Tesla.
Yeah, and there's Thomas Townsend Brown, and there's George Pigott, Ed Leedskalnin, and there's a number of people through history, and John Hutchison.
And these people can be accessed by going on the web to find out what their work is?
Whoa. To find out what?
He's asking if you can find out more about the names that you mentioned on the internet. Yes, caller, yes, you absolutely can find out more about them online.
Okay, the comment that I have and question is more of a question. What happened? Do you think that that was caused by an extraction of energy rather than putting energy to the towers?
Yeah, energy was directed. It was manipulated in some way.
So it wouldn't have been that energy was drawn from the existing structure?
I'm not saying that it isn't like a case of move something from point A to point B. It's a case of manipulating it, changing it, creating something from something else.
Right. Well, the way I was envisioning it, according to your description or analysis, was that some component of energy was extracted, causing a change in the whole structure.
It isn't necessarily that it's extracted or removed. It's the nature of it has changed. Let's take something that we're all somewhat familiar with, is how Tesla created electricity from a hydroelectric power plant by moving a conductor through a magnetic field. You move a conductor through a magnetic field and you get electricity. So you're changing, something. Magnetism and motion equals electricity.
Okay.
And so there's another aspect to this, and it changes things, it changes them around, and things do things differently than it's a totally different action. It's not like conventional energy that you're getting additional energy just to add to something or to take away from something. It's changing it.
Okay, do you remember, I know when I was growing up and I was a kid, there was something that we used to do as children where we would take four people and use one or two fingers, press down on a person, and then be able to lift them up with one or two fingers each.
I'm not familiar with that, so I can't, I don't know what it is. Sorry.
All right, well, thank you for the time.
Sure, thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, caller. Very interesting. We got another call. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Judy Wood.
Hello?
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, Tom from the Bronx here. I'd like to say, how would a high-intensity, sounds, would that be able to disintegrate, buildings like that?
There's no evidence that that is what occurred.
Yeah,
because
could it be part of the problem? I mean,
but it's not the evidence kind of contradicts that, because the seismic signal shows not much happening.
Well, this is like Buck Rogers coming right at us, isn't it? I mean, real life Buck Rogers. The old films they used to make like that.
What I'm looking at is what we see happen. What we see is that the building turned to dust in midair.
Yeah, well,
so we know that happened, and so we know that there's something out there that can do that.
There must be some devices they had someplace to do that. They must have maybe been a good distance away. Like you take a magnifying glass, right, and it gets the sun's energy, and you can start like a little campfire or something like that.
Yeah, it's not quite like that, but it
could be that principle, though.
Well, it's not like energy being concentrated down. It's an interference of different types of energy fields.
Yeah,
that
it. How long did it take you to learn all this in school?
When do you start school? it's the main thing here is being able to observe and see what's in front of you instead of what you're being told to see. In our culture, we get in the habit of seeing what we're told to see and what we expect to see, not what is right before us. And if you start looking at the images on 9/11 and you start realizing, wait a minute, those buildings are turning to dust. But we're told to perceive it as collapse or as an explosion or a bomb or, people tend to see what they expect to see, but it's a special, discipline to see what is there, and it's so important in this case to see what is there.
Our guest is Dr. Judy Wood. She is the author of Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. And we're talking about the thinking behind putting a book like this together. How did she do it? And we're going to go to the next call. But before we do that, Dr. Wood, can you give out your website address?
DrJudyWood.com. That's DrJudyWood.com. There's also the book website, which is WhereDidTheTowersGo.com. And from there, there's a link to Amazon if you prefer to buy it on Amazon, too. So
this is a massive book. It should be in every household in this country and beyond. We're going to go to the next call. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, caller.
Oh, all right. Yeah, I was just about to talk about the same thing about Nikola Tesla's and the free energy.
Okay.
Now, why can we not use free energy to power what we need?
Great question, you know, caller. Your phone is breaking up. We're not going to keep you on the line.
But that question, that is a very good question. And there's a lot of effort being spent to keep us from that. But the beauty, if there is any silver lining in the dark cloud of 9/11, it is that the whole world can realize that free energy technology already exists. Unfortunately, it's been weaponized. So there's no fear of that in developing it for all of us to use. But in doing that, I think we will come to see that we need to respect this technology because it could be disastrous. It could destroy the planet. But if there's free energy, there's no need to exploit people. And there's no need to be, you know, fighting over resources. It's a different world.
I could see how... Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Judy Wood.
Hi, how are you? It's Antonio. Yeah, hi, Dr. Wood. I have one or two questions. My first one is, well, I saw a film just yesterday about the goings-on on that day. And one of the things, the question I have is, would any helicopter, right, that's around the tower, because they were told they would have been able to rescue some people in the early, like, minutes of if they were able to go up on the roof, but they were told to stay away. So would directed energy or anything of that type disturb an aircraft like that? And this is why, because it would have been kind of funny if helicopters started falling down around the towers. Could they disturb? Would that disturb?
You put words in my mouth. You've read about the toasted cars.
Yes.
It turns out there, you know, if you had toasted airplanes, that would be a bad thing. There's actually an EMT who saw a plane turn into a fireball in the sky. But they it's interesting. They grounded all of the planes, even the top secret military missions. That's what they call them. Everything was grounded until 2 minutes after the second tower turned to dust. Then the top secret military missions could take off again.
Antonio,
helicopters were told to stay away.
I don't know about the helicopters, but I know that all the airplanes are grounded until 2 minutes after. That's uh-huh. 120 seconds after the North Tower's demise. I'm curious why there was no helicopters right next to the buildings when they went away, but. And who was in those news helicopters. But I don't know anything about policies that day, who was allowed to go up in
the... They also say that the roof doors were locked. Some people say that also happened, which... Are you planning, or some of your colleagues planning, to do an experiment with the smaller scale of this kind of stuff? Is there anybody doing it? I would love to see the concrete pulverized into powder. Is there anything in the works for that?
It's already been done.
Well, I mean, can you do it again and kind of make it fresh and documented and show the people?
There's frames from the video in my book, but also the video is available on my website. If you go to the book website, WhereDidTheTowersGo.com, in the upper right corner, there's a link that takes you to a video series, and you can look at the videos that go with Chapter 17. And it includes this block of iron that kind of crumples up and buckles over and, you know, it fumes away.
Good questions, Antonia. We're going to go to the next call. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Judy Wood.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, Dr. Wood, I remember from another show that this, I just tuned in late, that this was molecular disintegration. Is that correct?
Dissociation, yeah.
So, yes. What I wanted to ask is, since all matter comes from atoms, what is the difference between fusion and fission? Is that some component of this destruction?
It could be. Fusion is where you're putting atoms together or parts, and then fission is taking things apart. But I'm dealing here with the evidence of what happened on 9/11.
Uh-huh.
And there are some similarities with what has been referred to as cold fusion,
uh-huh.
or low energy nuclear reactions.
Uh-huh.
For example, the tritium that was found. The tritium is definitely above background levels, but
uh-huh.
it's not as sky high as you would expect with like a nuclear bombs
uh-huh.
or leaky nuclear plants. Also, your Geiger counter isn't going crazy off the chart.
But I was wondering, wouldn't that be detectable by a Geiger counter, that there would then be radiation exposure, or is it only toxic from the chromium, zinc, and the components?
The toxicity level, the Geiger counter business, that's something else. And the Geiger counters, weren't like off the charts. But there were values like, for example, tritium that were measured that are not normal. And so, something else is going on here. It's got a very short half-life by comparison. It's like 12 and a half years. And so it goes away rather quickly. And it's not all that toxic. But what is more concerned to be toxic that was going on that day is that the material was breaking down finer and finer and finer until it was the size of DNA, like a hundredth of the size of red blood cells.
Ooh, oh boy.
And inhaling that,
yep.
it goes right into the bloodstream and probably crosses the blood-brain barrier.
Dr. Judy Wood, we have another call here. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Wood.
Yes, hi. I'm from Queens, Eve. Dr. Judy Wood, I've had a little presentations at my house showing your film. And for some strange reason, I only had one person who was able to understand that they actually were able to destroy the seven buildings and not touch anything around it. And just one person got it. The
right.
We're like, what? They couldn't comprehend. So that's one, just as a statement. The second thing is, we keep getting rammed down our throats that there were bombs in the building. Is it possible that they did this direct free energy, and as a diversionary tactic, they put bombs in there to be able to concentrate on that and not have people really look at what really happened?
They don't need to put bombs in the building. All they need to do is do what they're doing now, which is talk about it. And get people to focus on the distraction. What the distraction is, the discussion over it.
Oh, that too.
So you don't even need to have bombs in the building. You just need to have chatter about it.
That as well.
It's easy. But the evidence contradicts bombs going off.
Dr. Wood, we're running out of time. We have enough time for another call.
Okay,
hi, you're
great.
On the air.
Yes, my name is Angela, and I love your show, Jeff. I'm one of those dullards you alluded to earlier in the show. I've heard you interviewed many times on different shows like Coast to Coast and Gary Noel, as well as Jeff's show, and I always had a question about, there was a storm you said that happened that day, and also you were saying there were fires or something going on in the building, and people were taking their clothes off, but
oh,
it
man.
Wasn't because
yeah.
of the fire. So I was wondering what the significance of those two things were.
Well, you got this another like half hour of discussion, but there's a lot of different things that are getting mixed in together.
Yeah.
What I'm doing is looking at the evidence and not speculating on what anything is for, but you can stop and just entertain all the possibilities in your mind of why somebody would be taking their clothes off. What it adds up to is something strange was going on that's not normal. Like 1,200 people left out of the windows, whether they voluntarily jumped or reflex action or whatever reason they went out the windows, they left the building. 1,200 people fell to their death. There's something weird in that. And then somebody, you know, dangling by a hand and a foot from the 105th floor, taking their pants off.
Dr. Ward, we're running out of time, but Hurricane Erin is the hurricane that was off the coast.
Right.
The most underreported hurricane, by the way, and as you pointed out, is a giant Tesla coil, which is needed for a static...
Produces a static field.
Static field for a for directed energy weapons to be used and create an interference zone and so on. And the story continues. Dr. Wood, it's such a pleasure to have you back on, and I want to have you back on the show again. Thank you, and have a wonderful evening, and good luck out there in Colorado.
Thanks.
That's going to do it for us. On Another News, I'm Jeff Brady. See you next week, 10 p.m. And if you're around tomorrow, visit us at Theater 80. We're going to show Why in the World Are They Spraying? I'll be there introducing the film and taking questions at the end. That's Theater 80. That's on St. Mark's in the East Village.
And one pill makes you small, and the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. And if you go chasing rabbits and you know you're going to fall, smoking caterpillar has given you the call. He called at us when she was just small. When the men on the chessboard get up and tell you where to go, and you just had some kind of mushroom.
If you've just had some kind of mushroom, you might need some health action. That's our next program. At 11:30, a rebroadcast of today's news from the local news team here at WBAI. But right now, time for health action. It's WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web.